IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. What sort of conventional and especially nuclear forces does India really need? How can it best use the resources it has to build deterrence? To get some insights into these issues today, Pranav and I are joined by Dr. Frank O'Donnell. He's a non-resident fellow in the Stimson Center South Asia program and also a postdoctoral scholar with the Rising Power Alliance project at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Until recently, Frank was also a postdoctoral fellow in the National Security Affairs Department at the U.S. Naval War College. And that's where he wrote a really fascinating report on the strategic postures of India and China. And we'll be discussing that report in this episode. A couple of years back, Frank and Yogesh Joshi also had out a very useful book called India and Nuclear Asia, which I would highly recommend to anybody interested in these subjects. Welcome to All Things Policy, Frank. And I want to start, Frank, with just asking you, how did you get interested, firstly, in strategic affairs and what drew you to Southern Asia?
Thank you. I've been interested in India as a researcher for over 10 years, and I find it just endlessly fascinating and challenging as a researcher. I often say to people who ask me this that India is one of the few countries in the world that faces simultaneously almost every single security challenge on the possible spectrum, ranging from terrorism up to counterinsurgency through the Naxalites and up to thinking about major conventional war and nuclear conflict. So as well as interesting in itself, how it chooses to respond to these cases, I think is instructive for how states should be thinking about these kinds of challenges in the 21st century. As you know yourself through watching it, things change regularly with regards to India and Indian security. And I became fascinated by it 10 years ago, and the fascination hasn't ended since.
Oh, wonderful. I was really struck by what you said, because yes, it's true that India faces this very broad set of challenges of all kinds. But at the same time, Indians certainly have the sense of being secure, or at least there's no sense of an existential crisis from an external actor in India, while that might exist in some other strategic cultures. You've also recently put together this visual guide about the strategic postures of India and China. What got you to do that? And secondly, what does it tell you about how India thinks about these issues?
It's interesting that point that you raised about, you know, how average, you know, overall Indians perhaps feel secure on a day-to-day basis. The responses that we saw, I think, during the Balakot crisis last year, I think perhaps would challenge that a little bit in terms of the amount of deserved anger against Pakistan for those actions.
For sure.
Moving on to the question about India-China relations. When it comes to strategic planning and many security observers and strategic experts in India, there is a common tendency to assume that China has this overwhelming, or at least, you know, comparatively stronger, both conventional and nuclear position against India. And this perception creates lots of anxieties in Indian strategic planning and begins to drive conversations around revising no first use, begins to drive conversations around beefing up the Indian conventional military presence. And so myself and my colleague, Alex Bolthrath, wanted to look at this in more detail and in particular try to see how far we could get in terms of compiling an open source study of what the capabilities actually are and the major commands facing each other. And so for India, these are, you know, the Eastern, Central, and Northern Army commands and their corresponding air commands. And for China, the Western Theater Command and the Tibet and the Xinjiang military regions. And we found that contrary to, I think, many of the assessments that we've seen and read about, India actually has a comparatively stronger position in conventional forces. It has roughly the same amount, roughly the same volume of conventional forces as China in the major commands facing each other. But the advantage is that India's are located far closer permanently to Chinese border areas than China's are. China's are mostly set comparatively further back, which means that while there is a comparable number, they would have to mobilize to get most of them closer to the Indian border area in the event of a major conflict. That would throw off huge intelligence signals that Indians would pick up on and be able to counter-mobilize if necessary, not just from those commands, but from deeper in India's interior. And on the nuclear front, again, a lot of the conversation around India's nuclear doctrine and posture does have this view of a threatening nuclear China in mind. And it drives a lot of the debate around questions such as, should India have multiple warhead delivery vehicles? Should India have the Agni-6, for example, which is intended to be further reaching even than the Agni-5? Should India have SSBNs, the Ariane? And so using the sources available to us, we found that India has, in our view, sufficient nuclear deterrence against China with the forces that it has now, and that the Agni-3s that we assess that are stationed in the Northeast can actually reach Beijing and Shanghai in and of themselves in that area. And so we argue based upon that, that there isn't a real need for example, an Agni-5, right, which can largely do the same thing. And that what India should be doing is thinking about its nuclear forces really in the same kind of way that China does, but having a largely land-based missile force that is mobile and that has grave greater survivability toward that end, as opposed to investing in very costly new platforms such as the SSBN fleet. So that's a lot there. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, we'll just get back to that. It's a really fascinating subject. But just going back to India's conventional posture, it's very interesting that, you know, the perception in India is that the Chinese always, that the Chinese have superior numbers on the border, but that's obviously not true. And you made a similar point in an excellent paper that you've written a couple of years back. And over there, you'd also argued that the Indian idea of seizing territory in China in retaliation to a Chinese territorial grab is something that requires a rethink in India. Is that correct?
That's a good question. And that's something that I think that is for Indian strategic planners to consider. It emulates to a certain degree the kind of cold start type thinking in terms of India can seize a limited tract of territory to use for bargaining advantage later on in conflict resolution. The challenge for that is for India to enter and seize a whole territory, similar to that in Pakistan. It has to be able to hold it. And India holding any territory within, not just within the kind of the border areas where there are disputes, but perhaps actual Chinese territory, will act as a magnet for any Chinese forces. They will surge everything to try to get the Indians out, simply for losing, so they don't lose face. And so that has to be planned for as what actually is a likely contingency in that case. By contrast, simply an almost cargo type approach, simply being able to surge Indian conventional forces to evict the Chinese from the areas of Indian territory that they have occupied, and then forcing them back and then stopping there, would do a lot to A, signal to the world that China was the aggressor, and B, win international sympathy for India's side and overall harm China's global image. So with regard to that kind of seizing tracts of territory, I think it's interesting to think through as an option, but there are some real challenges with that I think come into play with that.
Yeah, I mean, the one challenge that we keep hearing from military folks is that you know, the Chinese enjoy much greater mobility on their side. So seizing a bit of territory there, seizing a bit of territory on the Chinese side and then reinforcing it, defending it, becomes much harder for India. All right. I want to now just go back once again to those nuclear forces. Pranav, you had some questions.
So in the report, usually when India's nuclear doctrine in 2003, when the press release was given, we largely expected India to have rail mobile missiles. But a lot of the considerations right now has been road mobile. And we hear very little about India's development of rail mobile missiles, while China has some development on the conventional side of how it could mobilize its missiles on rail. Why is it that India has rail mobile missiles development shrouded in secrecy? And do Indian leaders consider rail mobile capability?
With regard to Indian rail mobile missiles, I wouldn't be surprised that they are in secrecy, because by exposing the rail lines, it makes it much easier for the rail lines to be cut, for example, by a Chinese offensive. There was a great report that came out recently by the Center for New American Security, which my colleague, Alexander Remen, contributed to, and which, you know, a link to that will be provided in the on the podcast website page. And I'd argue that in a very easy way that India should begin thinking about in terms of, in the event of a crisis, being able to limit the amount of Chinese mobilization into the theater is to simply cut the few rail lines that China has by use of, precision-guided missiles, precision strike capabilities. And so if India is focusing on developing rail mobile, simply transporting missiles by rail, it has every incentive to keep this as secret as possible. With regard to road mobile missiles, this is something that we actually argued in the report that India should be focusing more on. And this kind of goes back to, I think, the kind of overall model that India should be thinking about with regard to thinking about how China build this nuclear force, in that both states have the benefit of being geographically very large. This is not the same as, for example, the UK or, Israel, where they kind of have to rely upon an SSBN force because they don't have enough strategic depth within their own borders. There are many, many places within China and India where you can hide missiles. And so there should be a greater emphasis upon making more of the missiles road mobile so that they can be rotated around. And also so that it means that an adversary can never be fully sure that it has located all of them, which is core to where nuclear deterrence will come from, that there's not a first strike advantage, that there's not that kind of first strike confidence. Just a concluding point on that, though, is that, like China, India has every incentive to keep these kinds of details as secret as possible. Very few states want to reveal the precise transport lines that they use for the nuclear force movements for survivability reasons.
So that's a very interesting point about secrecy, because you've also studied how Indian leaders and how the media has portrayed India's nuclear forces and how the narratives have shaped Indian doctrine. The most common narrative that we hear is that India's nuclear doctrine is the world's most transparent doctrine. But in reality, in the 20 years, we know nothing more than what we knew about 20 years ago, except a few and far between statements that have been made and occasional public showcasing of the missiles. So is it right to say that India's is actually one of the more very secretive nuclear arsenals that we don't know about? And yet the doctrine gives us so little information about how India actually spends its money on nuclear forces.
That's a very interesting question. To start off on the doctrinal part, I think, if I have you correctly, where you come with the assumption that India has the most transparent nuclear doctrine might be a reference to its length, where the 2003 doctrine is, for a nuclear doctrine, fairly lengthy. Most nuclear doctrines, are a sentence or two, really, laying out the conditions in which they'll use nuclear forces. And it builds upon the 1999 draft nuclear doctrine, which is extremely lengthy. It's virtually an essay. However, within that, I think with regard to transparency, there's a number of different questions that arise from that. So, for example, you and I all follow the more recent debates about whether India still has a no first use doctrine. Most importantly, I think the remarks made by the then Minister of Defense, Rajnath Singh, about, to paraphrase, India has had a no first use doctrine in the past. What happens in future depends on circumstances. That's not a clear no first use doctrine commitment. There's also the challenge of the still remaining debates around the status of the 1999 nuclear doctrine. Although it's often commonplace for the Indian government and officials to point to the 2003 doctrine as the true official public version that should be taken as authoritative, and that the 1999 one was a draft, there's actually publicly reported in a public forum conversation at the launch of our book that you talked about previously, where former Indian Strategic Forces Commander B.S. Nagal said that for nuclear force planning reasons and for doctrinal reasons, that the 1999 draft and its language has a lot more relevance internally than the 2003 one. China's, for example, and there is this kind of continuing debates around whether or not India still has an oath-first use doctrine. And the seniority of the officials making this, these kinds of claims and kind of introducing a certain fog here, these are serving office holders, begin to introduce a certain level of fog around that. China, by comparison, at every opportunity, reiterates that it has a no-first-use doctrine and that its no-first-use doctrine is also unconditional. There aren't the caveats that are introduced in the 2003 doctrine with regard to biological chemical weapons that India has. So that's a little bit about just, you know, the comparative transparency. It's an absolutely fascinating question.
My second question was, you know, even though we say it's transparent, unlike the United States or unlike Russia, where we know where the money is being spent, on how the money is being spent, on what kind of weapon system, on what kind of radar systems, in India, it's a lot more secretive. All we know is that these are the missiles that were being developed. We don't know what is the development phase. We do not know how these weapons are being acquired, what are the conditions that are being taken into consideration before acquiring them. Well, in the US, even though they don't make any open statements, the number of public statements they make and the number of contracts which are out in the open, they give a far more open picture about the US nuclear posture. Would there be an incentive for India as a democracy to be more transparent about its nuclear development?
Yes, I think so, especially in terms of accountability. The reason why the U.S. is comparatively more transparent is that the legislature in the U.S., the Congress, is the one that authorizes spending of any money. The president cannot spend any money. And so as part of that, the Congress has conditions on how the money may be spent across the piece. And it has the right to ask to commission specific nuclear programs and to ask for updates on that and to ask for updates on how the money is being spent. And within India, this is part of a much longer institutional history of how India developed as a country. And there's a paper I wrote on this with my colleague, Arch Pant, that I'll provide a link to. It was published in Asian Survey. It was called something like On the Lines of the Agni Five and Strategic Ambiguity. And the head of the Department of Atomic Energy tends to serve as the chief scientific advisor to the prime minister. And the prime minister historically held the atomic energy portfolio himself. And this is where the nuclear weapons program originated in. And so there's a culture of secrecy that's been kind of built into the institutional setup of India right from the start. The most likely avenue for greater transparency to come from would be from the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Defense, which does, its reports, I think, are often not read enough and read widely enough, and that they do, I think, what they can to try to hold the government to account for certainly conventional platforms, but also where they can nuclear issues. The problem is that due to the institutional setup, the prime minister has the right to refuse information. And so the last time that the Parliamentary Standing Committee of Defense made a serious effort to ask for progress for details on nuclear weapons platforms was in around 2000 and 2001. And it came out in kind of the Ministry of Defense Standing Committee report response, and it said that we will not discuss these issues with you, the Parliamentary Standing Committee in Defense, even in a closed forum. You know, we're simply not going to talk about this with you. This remains secret. This remains classified in total. Where, by contrast, you know, these kinds of issues are openly discussed in the U.S. And so that means that there is less transparency in the overall program, and it means that agencies like the Department of Atomic Energy and the DRDO, the Defense Research and Development Organization, have a huge amount of discretion in terms of how they conceive of and plan nuclear weapons projects and the kinds of money that they allocate to them, and also what they determine as being a technically valid nuclear weapon platform, whether or not it is ultimately successful. And so for this to change, there has to be kind of a culture change within kind of the Indian nuclear state apparatus. And that change probably has to come from more dedicated lobbying by the Standing Committee on Defense for the Ministry of Defense and for the institutions that have talked about to be more forthcoming with regard to how nuclear weapons are planned, developed, and conceived in India and how the money is being spent.
Yeah, it really strikes me that you're actually bringing up a great puzzle, which is India probably doesn't need an ICBM like the Agni 5. It could probably do without ballistic missile and nuclear submarines. But why does it go ahead and develop these things anyway?
I think that, there is a rationale for Indian development of the Agni 5 and the Ariane. And, I want to be fair to the government and to people who argue in favor of this. The main benefit of the Agni 5 is that it would have the same capabilities as the Agni 3 in terms of its reach. It would be able to reach Beijing and Shanghai from nearly all places within India, if not most places. The Agni 3 has to be stationed in the northeast to be able to reach Beijing and Shanghai. With regard to the Arahant SSBN, this is in terms of just general force survivability. We know ourselves that the SSBN is the most survivable leg of any nuclear arsenal. This is why the British have moved to only a sole SSBN force, a single monad. And secondarily to that, I think this is simply part of the trappings of a great power status. That is, there's something kind of, when you think about what a great power is and has, you kind of begin to think about things like a blue water, fleet with aircraft carriers. You start to think about things as, its currency being a major global reserve currency. But you also start to think about things like an ICBM and an SSBN capability. And I think that it's part of India's own self-image as a great power that wants to have its capabilities, because that's part of the trappings what a great power looks like. But I think that's secondary. And I think that there is a real perceived threat to India's nuclear security that new strategic planners feel can only be met by the Agni 5 and the Ariane. However, that changes if, as our report reveals, the main reason for developing the Agni 5 and the discourse around it by the government and strategic experts was that this was the first Indian nuclear platform developed that could reach Beijing and Shanghai, when in reality, the Agni 3 can already do that.
That's very fascinating. And earlier you had mentioned about the draft nuclear doctrine of 1999. For me, when I look at a draft nuclear doctrine of 1999, and when I read many statements made by former strategic planners and people who write and think about all of this, the 1999 draft nuclear doctrine is more detailed in nature. There's a sense that such a doctrine would have done better for India, particularly because it did not have any caveats like reserving the right to use nuclear weapons in case of a chemical or biological attack. And more importantly, it called for punitive retaliation instead of a massive retaliation. So under the circumstances that Pakistan is developing tactical nuclear weapons, a lot would say that a massive retaliation would obviously not be a symmetric response. So how good would going back to a punitive retaliation posture actually do? And if India were to go to a punitive retaliation posture, what kind of weapons capability could it generally use in its current arsenal to sort of shape its posture according to a 1999 sort of doctrine?
This is an interesting question. And I agree with you that I think that the 1999 doctrine better overall fit India's strategic purposes, in that a really core challenge for India since 2003 has been trying to persuade Indian strategic observers, as well as those abroad, that the massive retaliation commitment is real, and that in response to perhaps the smallest Pakistani limited use of tactical nuclear weapons, India will simply largely wipe Pakistan off the face of the earth. And also threaten a Pakistani response if there were to be any remaining Pakistani missiles that would aim to do the same to India. With regard to, if India were to adopt or to readopt the 1999 draft nuclear doctrine, and again, going back to my earlier point that it seems that this still does have planning currency within Indian strategic planning, as B.S. Nagel talked about. Again, the platforms that it has now are largely satisfactory. There is the Prithvis, there are the air-delivered gravity bombs, there are the Agni 2, the Agni 3. If it came to that, and if India decided that it wanted to use nuclear weapons, the existing platforms that India has are fine. There's no need for example, development of India's own tactical nuclear weapons. There's no need for anything really new in that regard. What I found that interesting, and what I think was not really it didn't really get picked up as much as I hoped, is that in the Balakot strike last year, there was the air formation that went forward where it was, I believe, 12 Mirages with 4 to 6 protected Sukhois, and then the ISR planes to provide targeting support. That's pretty much what a nuclear strike formation looks like. And they even took off from IAF Ambala, which is the best public estimates have part of India's air-delivered nuclear force being based at IAF Ambala. So a Indian nuclear strike formation or something that looks like it takes off from one of the few bases that is seen as having nuclear weapons. And they're able to fly right into Pakistan-administered Kashmir and then release their payload into Pakistan proper. They were able to do this without and also fly back without being intercepted. And so when it comes to just going back to the earlier point about, you know, does India perhaps need new capabilities for, you know, use of Pakistan nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, I really don't think that they do. And I thought that was immensely telling that India was able to do this. And just the demonstration effect of this is that we can fly a nuclear strike formation into and out of Pakistan claimed territory and fire into Pakistan territory proper and fly back unhindered.
That's quite fascinating because I was reading James Acton's recent report on pre-launch ambiguity, and the anecdote that you painted was exactly representative of what a pre-launch ambiguity would look like between India and Pakistan. And in some ways, it's more frightening than calming.
Yes, no, I agree. Yeah.
Of course, somebody who's really worried about the state of India's nuclear forces will argue that before you ever get to a nuclear war, you might have a lot of attrition of your conventional forces, and you may actually lose some of these nuclear strike capable aircraft. But that's we're getting ahead of ourselves. So, but just going back to the argument that you've made about land forces, you've argued that India can actually restrict most of its nuclear arsenal to land-based mobile platforms. How would India go about doing that?
We argue that the platforms themselves are already in place. And while we think that the platform numbers are sufficient, I think it's probably reasonable to build some slight additional redundancy into there. So we've estimated that there are about 10 IED-3 missiles based in the Northeast, and that these could be upscaled to perhaps about 20 that are deployed. Another 16 IED-2 missiles, 8 of which are in India's Northeast, another 8 are in Central India. And so what we argue is that the challenge for India here is not so much building new platforms, but it's with regard to ensuring that the platforms are not fixed in place and they're not immobile and are thus easier to be picked off by Pakistan or China. And so we argue that there should be a slight upscaling of the Agni-3s from around 10 to 20 that are deployed. And the same with the Agni-2s, that there should be slightly more just to have this redundancy purposes. And that these should be made both more road mobile and rail mobile, so that these can be rotated much more frequently throughout India. And that secondly, that as far as possible, these should be held in disaggregated form in peacetime. And these can be held in part in bunkers with the warhead separate from the delivery vehicle. And again, this goes back to what the adversary's deterrence calculus is that if they don't ultimately know where all the missiles and warheads are, then they don't know that they wouldn't have nuclear retaliation against them. And that really the key thing we would emphasize is for India just to improve its rail and road mobility of its existing platforms. Again, and this goes back to the China analogy, because China is very good at this.
So in the bulletin piece, in the last section, you outlined some of the transparency initiatives, which might be either confidence-building measures or arms control measures. One of the difficulties for countries with very small nuclear arsenals has been the difficulty of forging any kind of arms control agreement. Arms control, especially nuclear arms control, has always been bilateral between US and Russia. So you have pointed out to some measures that could be taken as steps towards reaching some form of an arms control agreement. Can you talk more about that? And can you tell us how it would make countries like India with small arsenals much safer, even though having an arms control agreement would mean more transparency.
Yes, I mean, and this is certainly a challenge, and this is one that China, for example, grapples with in terms of how can it respond to U.S. calls for transparency when it's the Constitution and the philosophy behind this nuclear force has to have secrecy and deception as part of it. Because you can't allow a state like the U.S., which has multiples the nuclear force that you do, the ability to track and identify every single platform that you have in order to be able to hit them all with the first strike. And so what the bulletin piece talks about is, you know, it doesn't talk about the kind of provisions that you have and the much, much more advanced, and I would just say much older, and taking decades to build a level of trust protocols and formats that you have, the U.S.-Russian sets of arms control agreements, where you have on-the-ground monitoring, where you have, checks with regard to the locations of nuclear forces, where you allow officials from the other state to come on to your nuclear force bases and to check that. I recognize that that's simply out of the question for India, for China, for Pakistan as well. And that what India can do is, building upon our analysis that the Agni 3 is sufficient, that it can issue a unilateral pledge saying that we will not deploy a missile longer than 5,000 kilometers. As we argue that India doesn't need this with the Agni 3s that it has, simply doing that would invite immediate contrast between India and China and Pakistan, which don't have anything like that. And it would also help, I think, reverse the image that Chinese officials like to propagate, in that because China has an uncaveated no first use doctrine, it's more responsible with regard to nuclear weapons than India is. Furthermore, I mean, this goes back to a point you made in our book, which came out a couple of years ago, which you referenced, in that there has to be a strategic dialogue between India, China, and Pakistan with regard to their own nuclear and conventional threat perceptions. This dialogue can happen privately. It doesn't have to be happening in public with a grand meeting of heads of state. But there does have to be this dialogue. And this is something that certainly Chinese officials and experts privately recognize, in that there are a number of dangers arising from the way nuclear force development is happening among this trilateral relationship. For example, as India puts SSBNs out to sea and as China does the same, there's not really any kind of protocol or agreement like an unplanned encounters at sea between the U.S. and the USSR regarding what happens, for example, if an Indian conventional boat comes into hostile interaction with a Chinese nuclear armed boat that the Indian boat assumed was conventional. There are protocols you can put into place to peacefully de-escalate this, but issues like that need to be discussed privately, quietly, in terms of nuclear risk reduction. In terms of taking the lead on nuclear transparency with that pledge about, you know, the upper cap on India's nuclear, India's nuclear range, this would further help along its own campaigns for, you know, UN Security Council permanent membership. I think it would further help along its claim for the nuclear suppliers group, in that it was demonstrating that it was is going further with regard to nuclear strength and responsibility than China is, and reverses the narrative in that regard. The broader point is that it would help India a lot to be able to demonstrate that it is it has greater restraint with regard to its nuclear arsenal than China does, and to further deepen the wedge between that and Pakistan, which is a much stronger case for India. One thing that we discuss at the end of the bulletin piece is that, and I'm sure you recall this in your own research, in that following the 1998 tests, there were many people who you would not call kind of peaceniks, kinds of leftist doves, who were arguing that India should and can immediately declare an upper cap in the overall size of its nuclear arsenal. Many of these are retired military officials. And they made arguments in which, you know, around about 100 was probably the, to be honest, the upper limit in terms of the nuclear force cap that India would voluntarily announce to be put into place. This is something that I think should be looked at again. if we follow our analysis based upon our assessments that India has sufficient deterrence against China and India with the forces that it has, then there's not much that's really stopping India outlining this kind of public pledge. Again, with an eye toward the nuclear transparency efforts, and again, as part of trying to demonstrate that it is a more responsible and just exercises greater nuclear strength than China or Pakistan does, which will also help its great power image going forward.
So your broad argument would be that by doing this, India would not only gain diplomatic advantages, it would not actually affect its own nuclear security. And so it would be a victory all around for India. That's actually some pretty fresh thinking about India's nuclear forces. Thank you so much for joining us, Frank.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to speaking again in future. I appreciate this.
And thank you all for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.